Hello, reader. You're plugged in to another episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. We hope you enjoy it.
Hello, I'm Sean Duval. I'm news editor, books editor of News 24. And I'm here today at the PageCast studio to talk to Judge Edwin Cameron about his book written with two people we'll talk about, Rebecca Gore and Sohela Surajpal, Behind Prison Walls, Unlocking a Safer South Africa. So this is a book, Edwin, which is a substantial piece of work. I really, it seems to me that this is the kind of thing that could become a textbook in what is now called carceral studies, I believe. I see Angela Davis was a professor of carceral studies, so it has that imprimatur at least. And I mean, you've got 80 pages of notes in here, for heaven's sake. This is a very substantial piece of work. I mean, it's really a comprehensive overview of where South Africa's prisons are at, and the issues that arise from that, the experiences of people involved in that carceral system, and the sort of overview of the legislative elements. And you're obviously the perfect person to do this because you are the inspector, am I correct, the Inspectorate, JICS, Judicial Inspectorate of Correctional Services.
Perfect.
Right. So the thinking behind doing a book like this, you mentioned some personal aspects in the book. You mentioned in this an occasion, I think you were a clerk at the time, when experience in a prison where you felt very disempowered to help someone who had in turn, been incarcerated. And you tell a story in your second book, Justice, that your father, in fact, had been jailed for a time. So I wanted just to tell us briefly how those personal experiences fed into this interest of yours in prisons, and something that you've really taken up and worked quite hard on.
Sean, first of all, I'm absolutely delighted to be on this podcast with you. Secondly, I'd like to go back a step before I talk about my personal experiences. The book is a book of substance, and the substance comes largely from my two co-authors who wrote most of it, Rebecca Gore, as you mentioned, and Sohela Surajpal. But what I want to say, it's also an advocacy book. And the advocacy is what makes it interesting, because we say this is where we sit. Constitutionally, after 30 years, there's a constitutional promise to all persons detained, conditions of human dignity. And this is what we haven't achieved, but this is what we can achieve. And we think our book is like a template for a lot of disarray and a lot of dysfunction and a lot of disachievement in South Africa. And I think that's what makes our book interesting, that it's not, oh my God, I have to read this book about prisons. It's let's read this book about prisons to see what we can do. We as citizens, we as readers. So that's what drove us to write the book, that we can do better, as we can with Johannesburg's potholes, as we can with Transnet and PRASA. We can do better with all of those things. But Sean, as you rightly say, I was 7 years old. At the funeral of my elder sister, Laura, and in the back row of the funeral parlor of Afbob in Rebecca Street, Pretoria West, my father sat between two uniformed warders. And it made a burning impression on me. And it gave me an interest in prisons when I did my first inspecting judge visit to Zondervater. He'd been in Zondervater. And I asked the prison official accompanying us, where were the white prisoners in 1961 kept? And he pointed to me, cabins that Italian prisoners of war had built.
Yes.
And then the other thing, so that also burnt on me. And the other incident you mentioned was when I was a judge's secretary in 1976, just after the Soweto uprising in July 76, we go to Vereeniging Circuit Court with Judge Douglas Davidson, which I recount in the book. And several experiences there also burn themselves on my mind. But one of them, which is directly pertinent, is that the Connie Mulder minimum sentencing laws had taken dreadful effect. And Vereeniging Women's Prison, which held only black women, were filled with about 400 black women, all of whom had been caught in the web. Minimum 2 years for possession, minimum 5 years for possessing more than 113 grams, a lion matchbox full of dacha. And that also left a searing impression. The gross injustice, what people had been doing along the east coasts of Africa for hundreds of years, now kept these women in the cold July inside. So that was my impetus, and I was very privileged to work with two really brilliant persons as my research associate. First Rebecca, and then Sahela is still my research associate. And we wrote the book together.
You talk about the minimum sentencing and things like that. And you talk about the way this is a work of activism. I mean, you have been an activist in one form or another for many, many years inside and outside your judicial career. So I appreciate the fact that, we're looking here at what are the ways that the things that are wrong with the system can be changed. And you ask the question about, is abolition of prisons altogether, is that an option? Yeah. So that's very interesting. But you do need, obviously, in a book like this to outline what's wrong with the system right now and what the... Now, you know, we all know, and I'm sure, many of us have images in our minds of, you know, how dreadful it must be in many of our prisons, which are overcrowded. Conditions are not always very good in those prisons at all. And I'd like you to tell us a bit about that. But first of all, just outline to us the legal implications of that minimum sentencing and that change in the law that is one of the reasons that our prisons are overcrowded. You know, the awaiting trial prisoners who, are simply there because they can't pay bail and that kind of thing. So just outline to us that legal issue of minimum sentencing and why that.
You're asking about symptoms and causes. Let's start with the symptoms. The symptoms are a prison system which is built for 102,000 people and we jam-pack into it 165,000 people. So overcrowding is horrific, understated word, judicially understated word, and it's worse in the awaiting trial sections, which is why we've started the bail fund that we may talk about later. But the conditions are less than optimal, and of course, the working conditions for the prison's personnel are terrible because they put in danger by the overcrowding and they put in danger by the gang issues inside prisons, which for the past 120 years have been a feature of South Africans' prisons. So those are the symptoms. There's also a degraded Department of Public Works and an infrastructure that doesn't do the job in many public enterprises where it should. And it affects prisons badly. So you have a cell built for 22 people, housing 80 people. And this is in Durban Westville, which we visited a couple of months ago. They're not awaiting trial prisons where you can fantasize yourself, well, they're just awaiting trial, they're going to be there for a while. Many of them aren't. These are sentenced prisoners. And they sleep in double or triple bunks or on the floor. And at least the sentenced prisoners do get an hour of exercise every day. And the particular cell we saw in Westville had got a gallery in front of it where there was a snooker table where they could, when let out of the cell. One toilet. What was the word I used for latrine?
That was latrine. Now, that sounds official. Yes.
It's
one of those.
Yes.
For 80 people.
Yes. I thought you was going for what? For defecation and urination.
Well, yes. I know what it's for.
I wondered if you were asking me. Sean, so, and possibly two showers, often without hot water. Not so bad in Durban Westville, not even so bad in Pietermaritzburg, but very bad in Groenpunt Prison, which is on the southern banks of the Vaal River and very, very cold right now, even as we warm up in the August spring.
So, may I interrupt? Where is that? Groenpunt? It's close to Vereeniging.
Yes, you cross the Vaal, either on the highway or to Pietermaritzburg, turn left.
Okay.
And then so after about 60 kilometers, you get to Groenpunt.
Right.
In the Free State, Mealie Fields, more or less.
Mm.
And it's a huge prison with five max medium youth.
Mm-hmm.
So, Sean, let me just answer the other part of your question, which is causes.
Mm.
And the causes are you and me and the South African elite. And we took a wrong turn, a terrible wrong turn under Johnny de Lange in the first Mandela Parliament, when instead of committing ourselves to attending to the institutional features that effectively stop crime, which is accountability, detection, crime intelligence, policemen and women, prosecution, national prosecuting authorities, what happened? We placed our face in incarceration and in minimum sentences. I'm not going to give our viewers and listeners today a lot of figures, but let me give you one. 1995, how many people in South Africa serving sentences of life imprisonment? 495. 2025, August 2025, 18,600.
Jeepers.
It's a catastrophe and it's horrible and it hasn't helped us.
And that's because the law now mandates.
For an exaggerated, expanded list of crimes, including rape and murder. And I don't doubt that some rapists, perhaps many of them, some murderers, perhaps many of them deserve to go to prison for a very long time. But our system is skewed for the reason I'd like to give our viewers and listeners a second stat. We do a calculation in the book.
Mm.
We take the number of murders, which is over 27,000 a year, 70 per day as we sit here, and we divide it by the number of successful NPA prosecutions of murders every year, 11%. So it means that 89% of murders go unapprehended, unpunished, unprosecuted, unsentenced. So it's all wrong. We are sending...
So you're taking... Sorry, may I interrupt? You're saying 10-11% are...
Not
are reported. That's only 10% that are put before the police or that are investigated or that reach a conclusion in the courts.
The latter. But your question is a good question because it's a rough and crude statistic. So what we take is because murder is such an unhideable offense, you've got a body.
Yes.
The bodies are all reported except very few.
Mm.
And then you know how many murders are committed. And you also know from the NPA statistics how many murders are successfully prosecuted. And we took those figures. But your question
That's
is a good
successful
one. Are they reported?
Yeah,
yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So let me just say that we thought that incarceration was a magic bullet, and there isn't any magic bullet. Our solution, which we expound in the book, is rebuild crime intelligence. Jacob Zuma, and I want to mention his name, deliberately destroyed crime intelligence, SARS under Mr. Moyani, the NPA with shady appointments, who none of whom he... President
Menzi Simelane, for instance.
Yeah, Menzi Simelane. Yeah. At least the Concord, and I was proud to sit on the panel when Justice Yacoub gave his judgment, struck down that appointment because Menzi Simelane was a proven liar.
Mm-hmm.
But those succeeding him were also shady in other ways. So the Zuma had also destroyed the NPA, and he also destroyed the police with shady and incompetent appointments. So our non-magic bullet is we understand people's rage, and understand is a patronizing word. I respect people's rage and fear because I feel it. Rage and fear about violent crime. But we are not dealing with it. We are sending a smaller and smaller proportion of crime, rapists and murderers and other violent criminals to jail for longer and longer periods, and we think we're doing our job. We, the elite, the administration, the politicians, the media commentators, the book reviewers, the book writers. I've always admired you as a writer, Sean.
Thank you.
I had to get that in.
Thank
So we, the elite, are kidding ourselves, and we're not kidding the people who are really justifiably angry because our system of justice is failing them.
So you're talking about, or you're taking a step back and you're saying, you know, unless we address the causes of crime and the way that the state deals with Precisely. Criminal activity.
Yeah.
We will always have this kind of prison problem, but it is exacerbated by what seems to be a kind of legalistic attitude. So you change the law, increase the punishments, or make you can't punish someone so less than a certain amount. Which I mean possibly comes out of, as you say, that fear and rage at the violent crimes and that kind of thing that South Africans have experienced, so which have only got worse.
Can I give just one footnote to what you've said? Sean, we don't pretend to know the causes of crime because you have some vastly unequal society. Societies like Malawi, like Mumbai, your daughter can probably walk around on the streets of Mumbai, which is an even more unequal society than Johannesburg. Probably safely. I haven't been to Mumbai for a few years. Malawi, huge disparities, not the same. What we are saying and we concentrate on is that there has to be consequence management. It's a lesson from a children's home. I'm involved with children's home. You start with the youngsters and you say consequence management. We've lost that because our elite has distanced itself from what's happening. And the super elite, the politicians and the super rich businessmen surround themselves with security guards. And we say that can be changed. Start with crime intelligence. Appoint an honest, competent person, which crime intelligence hasn't had since 2011. And I'm sorry to malign General Kamalo, but reading what Jacques Poe says about him, I would say that we haven't had an honest, competent head of crime intelligence for 14 or 15 years. Build up the police. Appoint an honest, competent person to head the police and root out the corruption. And get, importantly, a fulfillment of the Glenister judgment, which Deputy Chief Justice Boseneke was the lead author of it, I was the secondary author, and it said,
This is in the Concord.
In the Concord, yes. And it said in 2011, you have to have constitutionally a corruption-busting agency with fangs, not the scorpions plus. Neither Parliament nor the executive, including President Ramaphosa, have done that. And if you have that kind of agency, you're going to find that several cabinet ministers and several top-level policemen and several MECs are going to be arrested very soon because the criminal syndicates are deep into the governing party, deep into the cabinet, deep into the police. But all of that is remediable, and our book is about remedies.
Before we talk about the remedies, let me ask you this. You've spoken about the law enforcement system, in terms of the police in particular. And it's obvious, I think, to anyone in South Africa who's observed this. I mean, they have a very large budget. I think
they have
talking
enough.
9-10 billion rand now for
we
the
have
police
a sufficient
in general.
Budget.
It's huge. It's very, very big. And there are a lot of cops around. But crime has not been solved. And you're pointing to the leadership, and specifically of the police, is very chaotic leadership with so many changes. Everyone's at everyone else's throats. We just had this recent incident, fingering a cabinet minister as corrupt and stopping investigations. I've just read Jeff Wicks's book about the Babita Deokaran murder and the fact that the Hawks muscled themselves into the takeover of that case. They took over that case just after the first group of six assassins had been arrested. And they comprehensively bungled it from then on. Deliberately or not, they bungled it. They let two people go who had guns and money on them. They just let them go, and of course they've disappeared. That kind of thing. They didn't look at her laptop. They didn't look at her. So, yes, the policing, I get that. In the hierarchy...
Under names.
Yes.
Under General Godfrey Labia,
yes.
Whom we called in on Tababesta. And what happened under General... I name names, Sean. What happened when we called in... We had a meeting with him at HQ. I sat next to him. And he was very diligent, and he listened intently, and nothing happened. Please proceed. I want to hear.
So that's yes. I want to hear about the Thabo. I was just talking about you've spoken about the police, in the prisons hierarchy, the ministry or the Department of Correctional Services, is that department in and of itself a problem and dysfunctional down to the level of the actual prisons? I mean, is it administrative issues there? Are there
nuance? We failed a lot of constitutional promises and we haven't fulfilled 35(2)(c), which says conditions of detention consistent with human dignity. And so the prisons department fails in that respect, but it's better than most government departments. I would not say a word against the current national commissioner for two reasons. The first reason is that I think he's working hard and he's working with integrity. His name is Mr. Makoti Tokgale. The second reason I wouldn't say a word against him is that he replaced Mr. Arthur Fraser. And put that in brackets, but you can smile. I hope that the camera is catching your broad smile. So the prisons department is better than most. And let me give you an instance. When I was appointed on the 1st of January 2020, and 10 weeks later, we've got the COVID crisis. I expected our prisons to be a horror show, as some prisons were in North America, in South and Central America, and elsewhere in the world. They weren't, because there's mostly effective healthcare, there's mostly effective management of it. Not to detract from the overcrowding that we spoke about. So I'm not whitewashing the prisons, but they better run than, there's less of a betrayal of constitutional promise with our prison system than there is in almost every other government sector. So that's the nuance I want to bring.
Yes. I get that. I mean, that's
can
good
I get
to know.
Back, Sean, sorry, to Babita Deokaran.
Yes.
The point about our corruption is that it isn't just, the corruption at prisons level comes from the warders, the personnel. They take in the cell phones, they take in the dachan and gather now more serious drugs. They take in the money and not the majority of them, a minority who aren't corrupt. But major corruption in South Africa is now criminally syndicated. And what you are telling me about Babita Deokaran's investigation and the Hawks signals to me, and I don't know the facts, so I'm not giving a fact, but it signals to my legal mind a suggestive inference that a criminal syndicate has been at work in the Gauteng Health Department and has its tentacles right inside the Hawks. That's why it's so important to get a new unit, Scorpions plus, starting with competent personnel and honest personnel, and we can do that. We know that we've got honest and competent people who want our country to run. We don't need to leave it in the hands of the criminal syndicates and the criminals themselves.
And having said that, I think, I mean, just, you know, a brief personal experience of trying to help someone who was arrested and was in jail for a while in Sun City, as they call it, which is the one just south of Joburg, which sounded like the conditions there were fairly awful, but not perhaps the worst.
Was this person awaiting trial?
Yes.
And male?
Yes. And white. What struck me about just sort of my experience of that in that time was that he was able to get hold of me by phone pretty much every day, even though, or every second day or something, there was regular contact. And he was telling me that, you know, he wanted a bit of money for this and a bit of money for that, because the way he put it was, the gangs run the show here entirely. It's as though the warders are employed by the gangs. The gangs run the show. They decide who gets what when. They have a financial system, you know, for remitting money from one party to another. There seems to be, you're talking about, you know, criminal syndicates and extractive syndicates like at Tembisa Hospital in the Deokaran case. But my sense of it was that the gangs really are very embedded in all our prisons. I mean, does that chime at all with your you know, they kind of, they really run the show? I mean, is it that? I mean, do you have the impression that that is as bad as it is that they?
And I think we're talking about two different kinds of gangs. The one is the kind of criminal syndicalism that I've been referring to. The second is a deeply embedded gang culture which started in about 1910, mm-hmm. And is documented by Zaki Ahmed and Charles von Onsel and others, mm-hmm. and it's deeply and Johnny Steinberg, of course, who appeared, yes, mm. and in his subsequent writings as well. Mm. So that gang system, which runs inside the prisons, also has tentacles outside. How far it has merged with the criminal syndicates that have taken over parts of government and provincial and municipal governance in South Africa since over the last 30 years, I don't know. Mm. But they are two distinct gang systems, and that they have interconnections, I have no doubt. Mm.
Now, I was just interested in the idea that, in the same way as you kind of look at the Tembisa hospital problem, it's almost like the syndicates were running the hospital.
I think
In parallel, one kind of gets the sense, or I got the sense from this person that it was all down to the gangs. I mean, it was, you need 200 rand, otherwise you're not going to get a blanket. And food and drugs. I mean, there were plenty of drugs.
Yeah. They are
flowing in and out.
There's seldom a prison that I don't inspect where there isn't the delicious waft of fresh dacha, mm-hmm. and that's brought in. Sean, can I make another just quick footnote to what mm-hmm. you've said? A prison cannot be run by the personnel alone. This is no prison in the world, and our prisons resemble those in a much more lavishly resourced country like the UK. The prisons mm-hmm. of England and Wales have symptomatically the same problems, perhaps not on the same scale as we do. But it's often a sort of a dynamic equilibrium between the prisoners themselves and the personnel. And gangs infiltrate, even in the UK, in America. I don't know what I'm talking about now, but I do know what I'm talking about in South Africa. Mm. So there has to be an equilibrium, because you simply, that equilibrium, the only time I've ever felt in physical danger was when I didn't go to a prison, but to a detention center for cross-border nationals who were undocumented, non-nationals. And they don't have the same equilibrium. And we nearly got into trouble there because someone started getting very angry and shouting and people got restive. We whisked away. Mm. But I would have been very sad if I'd harmed any of my three clerks who were accompanying me. So just to say there is an equilibrium, an unspoken understanding. It's not explicit. Mm. But you don't beat us up, you don't get stabbed. But if you do stab, you'll probably get beaten to an inch of your life because we'll call in the... unspoken equilibrium.
There's a kind of symbiosis the gangs, there you're talking about. Kind of, they have sort of have to kind of work
to survive,
in a way. And we mentioned Thabo Bester in passing, and I want to ask you about that. I would ask you that about that story and what happened there exactly, and how your inspectorate played a role in uncovering the fact that he'd escaped, and that was not public knowledge at that time. That was from a private prison.
G4S.
Yes.
Name names.
That G4S, was a private prison.
For which we pay them still 35 million a month.
For that particular prison?
For one prison.
Gosh.
For 2,999 prisoners.
Gosh. That's what I wanted to ask you. And in the context of that's a private prison. You've looked at presumably private and, government-owned prisons. Is there a meaningful difference? Yeah. Is there...
The private prisons are much better resourced. Hmm. They're training workshops at G4S. They're training workshops at Kutama Sintumuli up in Makado, formerly Louis Trichardt. But it's a terrible idea, Sean. This is a duty that lies on us. We can't outsource it to a corporation. And the Thabo Bester is only the worst manifestation of the corruption, the inefficiency, the mismanagement that features G4S. Mm. And this, I hope they sue me for, because we would go to prison, we would go to court. I nearly said court and prison. We'd go to prison and we would to court and we'd prove it all. Mm. And the Thabo Bester was the manifestation of the degradation of the management systems and the lack of caring from the very top. I spoke about General Godfrey Labeer, went to a meeting with the head of G4S in Africa and the Middle East. And I think he was spoofing us. He said, oh, you know, raised his eyebrows. Mm. I looked at his fingers. He'd never been inside a prison cell. They were the fingers of a piano player.
Oh.
So all of that's to say just that it came from the top, the unconcern and the big fat monthly payment. There were 22 people on duty the night that Thabo Bester got out. Mm-hmm. And there were many, many more people when the television set arrived with the corpse. Mm-hmm. There were many people who were on duty who didn't look inside. So it was either people terrified or in the know and on the make or being paid off to look away or be silent. But that was a managerial failure of colossal proportions. The story, many of your listeners, I don't know, read Daniel Stain, Marisha Diamonds, mm-hmm. and Daniel Stain. They wrote a fabulous book, and I didn't expose it. Ground Up exposed it.
Yeah, they're the Ground Up people who
exactly.
Did that, yeah.
So I gave them the tip, and I gave them some information, and they scrupulously followed up. And the book is the result. So for people who want to know about the television set and the corpse and the actual night when everything malfunctioned, of course, the auto doors and of course there was one fleeting moment that our investigating head, Leonard D'Souza, found, and the hard work of our investigator on the ground in Free State, Ms. Dineo Mutumi, they were the ones. I take no credit either for the expose or for the follow-up. Leonard said to me, the day we heard promptly, he said to me, that's very strange, very hard to commit suicide under your own bedding. So Leonard was onto it from the start, and we uncovered it over the next weeks.
I mean, it was a strange thing, really, to
bizarre
assume that someone had basically burnt themselves to death in their own bed, and nobody noticed.
Under his own mattress.
Under his own bed, and nobody noticed that. Until when? Next morning?
No.
They didn't think anything was suspicious.
Until 4 a.m. when the smoke was coming out. The smoke
drifted down the corridor.
No, the whole story is outrageous.
It was all just very odd. And that whole escape and everything. I mean, I don't want to say necessarily covered up. Maybe you can say it was covered up. But I mean, it certainly wasn't revealed. It wasn't spoken about. It was a cover up. You're saying it was a cover up.
You are the investigative journalist. I'm the judge who doesn't say things. I would never say it was covered up. What I can say is that to every agency I went, there was no response. The National Commission, I'm not saying that he was part of this because he's got people on the ground and he's got people in charge of all of this. Mm. Once they activated it after the ground up expose, they managed to trace Thabo Bester and Dr. Magrimana and follow them to Tanzania. Mm. And I believe that was also Mozambicans and Tanzanians, but we were also involved, and the National Commissioner's unit was also involved. So things did happen, but very, very late. Mm.
Did it give you some sense overall that your inspectorate can make a difference in the short term, in the medium term, in the long term, dealing with those kinds of problems, the corruption within prisons, the private prisons seem lack of oversight or lack of care.
It's very difficult. Corruption is part of our mandate, and I would say that it's the most difficult part, and I would claim no successes there. But we are a Mandela-era institution. He put it into the Correctional Services Act of 1998 at the same time as Johnny DeLong was wrecking everything. And he also said, make it topped by a judge for authority and for voice. And I've got a voice. But we do good. There's no doubt about it. We field enormous numbers of complaints. A lot of the personnel, including Mr. Makhoti Tobukhale, are happy for us to be there because we assist. And that raises the other question, which is, are we simply flowering a corrupt system, or are we really helping? I think we do help, and I think we intervene for families. I get many, many angry letters, and I get many, many letters of thanks from families and individuals. There's no doubt our Eastern Cape head, Mrs. Justine Gericke, has observed, and I'm going to get some master's or doctoral student onto this. She says, where we don't have a prison monitor, an ICCV, Intervention Correctional Center, a visitor, violence levels go up, inmate on inmate, inmate on personnel, personnel on inmate. Where we do have ICCVs, they drop. So I have no doubt that we do good in the same way that lawyers under apartheid did good. Yes, Sidney Kentridge and George Bizos and Arthur Chaskalson did good. Should they have stayed within the system? It's a good debate. And the same debate is one that we actually consider in the book.
Although if you were to in some way step outside the system, I mean, how does that, that doesn't necessarily help anything at all. I mean, because once you're outside the system, I mean, then it's like total revolution and total transformation of society. Otherwise, you know what, you're not, you're outside the system. You don't then go before a judge or before a committee and say, this is my problem. Can it be solved?
If I'm understanding you correctly, I'm not a prison abolitionist because I think you've got to do things with society, which no society has yet done. I think some people have to be locked up. There are some dangerous people. What we say in the book is that our sentence inflation, our life sentence inflation, our minimum sentences are a desperately wrong search for a magic bullet. We say there's no magic bullet, but building up the institutions that curb crime and that we say that that can be done, starting with the police and crime intelligence.
And when you talk about in the context of that, and you say, you know, we do need, you know, there's certainly at present some kind of need for some kind of prison system, but you talk about remediation. What does remediation mean in that context?
Remediation means consequence management for all crimes. And this is a terrible thing to say, but if you have shorter sentences for every single rapist, you do not let as any single report of rape go unexamined, unprosecuted, unfollowed up, unarraigned, convicted and unsentenced, rape will come down. That's the certainty of what we've discovered. There are very few things that we know about.
So it's not about the length of the sentence. It's about bringing more people to trial and concluding.
So we are sentencing a tiny minority of rapists to life, and we think we're doing a job we're not. So remediation is also other things that we examine, good news things. Community service, and it sounds like bleeding heart. No, this is not bleeding heart. This is effective consequence management. We had, under Bosasa, which was famously corrupt, we had a parole band system. What do you call these ankle bracelet systems, which flourished for a few weeks and then after the hundreds of millions for it were paid, stopped working. Now, a lot of things like that, like the electronic door system. Yeah. I'm glad you're smiling, Sean, because I want to bring a bit of wry.
I mean, it is kind of funny.
A bit of levity. It is, because that's what happens with corruption. They run off and then they get the next tender. So, and that's syndicated. So there are many ways that we can remediate. And obviously it's a big job. And obviously it's going to take a lot of do-good people. We've got a lot of do-good people, not just in NICRA, not just in many other institutions that are working in crime hotspots. One of the things that we say remediated, to use your word, is to take a different approach on drugs. The gang warfare in the Western Cape townships, where we have the highest murder rate, not just in South Africa, but in many places in the world, vast high murder rates, I think is drug crime fueled. And we say that if you look at Portugal, this is not an unvarnished advocacy for decriminalization of drugs. It's one said with care. Portugal has abolished most crimes on drugs, the minor offenses, and treated as a public health hazard, which is right. Not bleeding heart. President Kgalema Motlanthe is not a bleeding heart. He has signed a declaration with other presidents, mostly from South and Central America, but also the former president of Switzerland, to say, stop this insanity. Stop the insanity of the war on drugs. Deal with it the way you deal with alcohol, which is also a drug and also harmful, and deal with it as a public health issue, an advocacy issue. And I, the one thing I can say with passion, not with certainty, is that the dreadful death rate in the Cape Town townships will come down if you approach it differently, the drug issue.
Thank you, Judge Cameron. Very, very interesting. Our prisons, difficulties there, problems like many issues in South Africa, but it's interesting to hear from someone who's really looked into it and to get the sense that there are solutions, there are ways forward. We need not despair. And I think that I think your point about the Constitution is apt, because I think in many ways that would guide a lot of what might in fact be done in this area. So thank you very much for your contribution for this book. Very, very interesting. And I hope a lot of people pick it up and read it.
Thank you, Sean. Lovely to have been here.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Did you love what you heard? Don't just stop at the stories. Buy the books. Visit your favorite bookstore to grab your next read. And remember to subscribe, share, and join us again next week for more fascinating conversations. Until then, happy reading.